In the episode 56 of Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast, I am interviewing Simon Herman from Chainflip. So what is Chainflip? Chainflip is a cross-chain swapping protocol. And Simon is someone who is extremely knowledgeable when it comes to all things crypto, blockchain, and Web3. He has been in this industry for 7 years. For anyone who knows this industry, that means that he is a veteran. He has been through ups and downs many times, and he understands everything that is going in this industry. And so it was extremely interesting having this conversation with Simon. We talk about all things from vulnerabilities in the crypto market, the latest FTX saga, the role of centralized exchanges, Silvergate, Grayscale, thing in Web3, and so much more. Hello, innovators, explorers, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. I'm your host, Sam Kamani. I am an Amazon best-selling author, a tech startup founder, and a strategic advisor to multiple Web3 startups. I'm here to take you on a journey to explore the world of Web3, all the risks, all the opportunities, and my goal is to educate you about what other people, the founders, the investors, what are they building? What are they paying attention to? So you can take advantage of it, so you can benefit from it. However, I would like to start with saying that this is not investment advice. I would still highly encourage you to do your own research. I have nothing to sell you. So with that out of the way, let's get into it. So Simon, it's great to have you on the show. So looking forward to talking with you. I love hearing the Australian accent because I live so close to this part of the world. So I'm excited to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Sam. But I'm calling in from the other side of the world today, Berlin. I'm a foreigner here. It's fun.
No, that's really, really cool. So let's just get started and tell me about your project Chainflip and everything that you do at Chainflip.
Sure thing. So yeah, I founded Chainflip in 2020 as a breakoff project from my original project, Oxen, which is still running, privacy project down in Australia. And it was inspired by the idea that, you know, despite the fact that there are cross-chain protocols and there were things under discussion back then, you know, there still really isn't something that can do cross-chain swaps in the same way that Uniswap can. So Chainflip is an attempt at trying to displace the centralized exchange in the same way that Uniswap was really successful in taking away a lot of the spot volume from the ERC-20 token market. So yeah, that's really what we set out to do. And I can tell you a bit more about how that works throughout the conversation, I suppose. But yeah, long story short, we're trying to be the Uniswap for, you know, the other really huge liquid markets, like, for example, Bitcoin to USD on just Binance alone has done more volume than all other DEXs combined forever. I think there's been a couple of days where that might not have been the case, but this one trading pair is more liquid and does more volume than all DEXs, all pairs combined. So that just gives you a bit of an idea of, you know, just how underserved the rest of the crypto spot markets really are when you think about, you know, where people are actually trading, where people are actually swapping. And yeah, I guess, you know, in light of recent events, I think it's quite a pertinent topic with the collapse of FTX and, you know, the centralization question coming back to the forefront of the discussion. Yeah, Chainflip is here to help, I suppose.
Yeah, that's good to know. So why is it that it is so big, like just the BTC? Is that the biggest sort of pair kind of thing, or what do you call it, like the transaction?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the most liquid, highest volume market in the space by an extraordinary margin. I don't know why that is personally. I'm probably going to annoy a lot of people right now.
Yeah, I have some theories. Okay. So because of my experience in this space and a lot of the places, that's how it used to work, that you want
everything
to
was paired in Bitcoin, right?
Yes. You want to on-ramp onto crypto. That is the first thing you have to do is go BT to BTC. And it was so USD centric that you had to go from NZD or AUD to USD, and then from BTC, and then to Ether, and then to all the other smaller chains and stuff, or smaller tokens and stuff. So that used to be the on-ramp.
No, well, I don't think that used to be. I think that's been the case for like the last 3 years. I remember buying Bitcoin directly, and then all of the altcoins, yes, they were called altcoins back then,
yes,
were,
yes,
paired in Bitcoin. So
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. So you buy Bitcoin, sort of basically
set the market.
Yeah, yeah. You buy the Bitcoin, and then you get, then you're on-ramped onto the crypto world. I mean, it's changed slightly, like with the likes of MoonPay and things like that. So it's a early 2020. You want to buy an NFT? You need to get a BTC first, then go to Ethereum, and then buy that NFT. And now you can use straight credit cards. So there are different new ways that people are, they have on-ramped onto crypto, but the pairing hasn't changed. It's still the BTC USD.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think like everything being denominated in USD now to Bitcoin, it's sort of, for me, like I question why Bitcoin remains by far the largest market. Like I would have thought that Ethereum would be, you know, just as large, but it's not really even, well, it's close, but it's not that close. And I don't really understand, like personally, I think I've lost interest in Bitcoin as a project. It'll always have a place in my heart, but yeah, I think it, needless to say, I think that things have moved on a bit and the project hasn't really kept up, for better or for worse, you know. Okay. I think
so. That was my first theory. My second theory is just brand recognition, and like people don't know, like most, like we are early. People don't, it's like, has your mom asked you, what do you do? What do you tell her?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
She has. She knows a lot about what I do.
That's good. What about your grandparents?
She always wants to buy, you know, the token of the project or whatever. I'm like, mom, relax. It's fine. Like.
Oh, that's good, man.
Don't make it by life hard.
That's good. Like for most people, like in their 50s, 60s, 70s, they don't know. They've heard the word Bitcoin, you know. It's like they don't understand. They don't have concept of blockchain. They don't have concept of Ethereum programmable sort of smart contracts or anything. It's like it's too foreign to them. They only know Bitcoin. And the same, who are leading and managing funds, whether it's retirement funds, whether it's investment funds, they are people in their 50s, 60s, 70s. They have brand recognition with Bitcoin. They don't have brand recognition with, I don't know.
I mean, that's true. But those like people Polygon also don't trade on Binance, right? Like,
yes,
the Binance is actually a pretty difficult platform, let's say. Yes. Like the whole verification thing and all that. It's really not set up for those retail traders. And yet still, it's by far the largest market in the industry, the Bitcoin USD one of Binance. I don't really know why that is. But anyway, the point stands is that, you know, there are these huge markets out there, and even stuff that is supported on, like with on-chain trading, like a lot of the EVM chains, for example, yes, like Avalanche and so forth, the liquidity you can get by swapping across chains through the bridges and stuff is still very limited. And the centralized exchanges still have a lot of relevance, because a lot of the time the liquidity pools that you see on those chains to swap like USD to AVAX or whatever, they're actually pretty not great. And so, you know, you can definitely get a better deal by using a centralized exchange. And this is the sort of thing that, you know, we're trying to make a difference in. We've built this custom AMM design called the JIT AMM, where we have a Uni V3 pool design operating in this sort of virtual off-chain other place, which is its own blockchain called the Chainflip State Chain. But then we've layered a limit order system on top of that as well. And because we have these block confirmation delays that are introduced just by being cross-chain. So, you know, when you make a deposit into an exchange, you have to wait a certain number of blocks before the deposit is confirmed. Same sort of idea here, but instead of the deposit being confirmed, you know, we then immediately swap that deposit. That allows the market makers and such to say, okay, I've got, you know, 100K of Bitcoin or Avalanche or Ethereum or whatever coming to be swapped in X amount of time, or roughly X amount of time. So they know how much liquidity they have to go and find on the centralized exchanges or on other AMMs or whatever the case may be. And they can actually offer a price and try and compete with the other market makers to give the user the best price. So, you know, we're trying to make this cross-chain swapping thing extremely capital efficient by introducing these dynamics that'll allow the same level of liquidity provision that is happening on the centralized exchanges and the decentralized exchanges at the same time to occur for users of Chainflip. which we think will make it extremely capital efficient. And also, hopefully, we'll be able to beat a lot of other AMMs, cross-chain solutions and such on price and win in the aggregators game. We'll see.
Yep. So because I am not from a trading background, I'm still trying to understand like how does the whole cross-chain dynamics works. I mean, even before Chainflip. So what used to happen? Say someone wants to move from one chain to another.
Well, you log on to Poloniex or Binance or FTX or whatever, and you do it there. That's been the best way forever. And it still is the best way. You know, like it's not really practical to do, like, let's say you're a bit of a whale and you want to buy 100K worth of Bitcoin. Like, there is no decentralized facility to do that at the moment. That isn't going to cost you like 5 to 7% slippage, which is just insane. Yeah. So, yeah, there isn't in a lot of cases, but there are other protocols at the moment. There's a lot of cross-chain bridges or messaging protocols that allow for things like USD to be ported from some chains to some other chains. So at the moment, for example, you can use a product called Li.Finance, which will aggregate a bunch of different bridges and a bunch of different messaging protocols. And you can go, all right, I have Ethereum, but I want Avalanche, for example. And it will, first of all, it will swap Ethereum into USDC on Ethereum through Uniswap. Then it will port the USDC that you have onto off the Ethereum chain and on to the Avalanche chain. This is done through a kind of, you can think of it like minting and burning. So you burn it on the Ethereum chain and it pops up on the Avalanche chain. Doesn't really work that way in practice, but we'll ignore that for now. That's
easy to explain.
Way to understand it. Yeah. And then with that, finally, it gets swapped from USD to Avalanche on Trader Joe, which is the Avalanche equivalent of Uniswap. So you're using two separate AMMs, two separate liquidity pools, and a cross-chain messaging bridge in between. But that's only possible through the EVM chain. So anything that's kind of based on Ethereum. But there are so many more markets than that. Yeah, exactly. So there is more to crypto than that. I mean, you know, there are a bunch of Ethereum. There are a bunch of Ethereum-based chains now, but you know, there are many more designs out there that have kind of been left out in the cold. And they're entirely dependent on, you know, people like OKX and KuCoin and Binance and so on. And yeah, it's not great.
It is not great. It is like, this is like pretty much like buying all your gas from the Russians. It's like, it's dependent on like five big exchanges, centralized exchanges. It's like
literally
one fails and like wipes out like a third or like, you know, quarter of the crypto market. What happens if like three or five big ones fail?
And I think what a lot of people don't realize is if you run your own blockchain and you really are dependent on like one or two exchanges, you know, they have a lot of leverage over you. They can really compel you to meet certain targets or do certain things. Or, you know, let's say you want to upgrade your blockchain, for example, you know, do a hard fork or something like that. If the exchange doesn't support that hard fork for whatever reason, whether it's just because they can't be bothered or there's some other reason, they essentially have unilateral control and can say, no, not going to upgrade. And then you're kind of stuck. So any like smaller project that has its own blockchain that isn't connected to some sort of decentralized market is basically at the mercy of some of these centralized exchanges, in the same way that Putin thought Europe was at his mercy at the start of the war with the gas. Yeah. I think that's a great analogy, actually.
true. But you know, why do bridges get such a bad name and bad rep when it comes to security and stuff? And there's been like, there's always considered like dangerous or I don't know, like they have security vulnerabilities and stuff.
Well, because they've done generally a pretty bad job at it in the past. I mean, like there's $100 million hack every other week, it seems. And that's been going on for like 2 years now. Yeah, I guess like I don't really understand why bridges have become so popular, but it seems that every time one gets hacked, another three pop up in its place to try and replace it because that one's name is, you know, dragged through the mud. But, you know, this sort of mad rush to create these bridges is, I think, largely responsible for the lackluster security that we've seen. And just that if you create a system that is centralized, it's quite simple in a lot of cases. And that simplicity can be good, but it also means that it's difficult to build a layered defense. So all you need to do really is convince the bridge that it owes you money when it actually doesn't. That is essentially the common link of any bridge hack. And there are multiple ways that this has been done, either through exploiting smart contracts that have been unaudited or audited by firms that are terrible, like Cert, don't use them.
And they charge 10 to 100,000 per smart contract audit. You know, that was one of the, like, I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to build and why we built cookbook.dev is because it's like, why does everyone who wants to use a smart contract needs to be like, we get one smart contract, it's audited and stuff, and then you create a template from, like, use it as a template. And so everyone takes benefit of that. So, and just kind of like use crowdsource or user generated sort of security, that if people can eventually comment on it and we want to create our system like that. So, and completely open source, free to use platform. So that's what we had.
Yeah. And that's great, right? Like the amazing thing about the Ethereum ecosystem is that, all of these projects out there are available to be used. Essentially, all these contracts are out there to be used. And if you're not going to make any serious modifications to the functionality or the logic, like, you know,
if you're doing a token or burnable token or something, just changing the name and something, you don't need to, you know, changing the name and the number of amount of the tokens you are minting.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Like, there's no need for an audit there. And like, you know, the ERC-20 token standard has been out there for however long. Like, nothing's impossible, but, like, you know, the DAO hack was sort of the first big wake up call, like, oh shit, you know, smart contracts can be quite vulnerable, but, you know, copying stuff is a good strategy for sure. And having access to seeing how other people do it is also very useful, because a lot of the time, even when you're developing your own contracts, it's always good to look at examples of competitors, because they might have thought of something that you haven't, or got some feature in there that is actually turns out to be essential. So yeah, definitely a cool product. I think that with the bridges, though, that doesn't stop there, right? You have the smart contracts, which is like an important element a lot of the time, but you also have the back end as well, where there's actually keys and a wallet, and they're storing various assets or you know, something of that nature. There's some sort of custody thing going on there, whether it's centralized or decentralized in the sense that it's a 5 of 9 multisig, which is not really decentralized at all. It's just distributed key management, but that has gone wrong as well, because I can't remember which bridge it was. I don't want to get it wrong. I think it was Nomad, but don't quote me on that. The reason why they got hacked was because they had a 5 of 9 multisig, but one guy had 4 of the keys. So they just had to nab him and one other, and that was it. Like, they had full control over everything, and then it was just gone. So crazy stuff. But yeah, like, layered defense is essential in any sort of cross-chain or any sort of custody dependent, you know, service. And when I say custody dependent, I mean, you know, there is an account other than the user that is involved, whether it's controlled in a centralized or decentralized manner.
Yeah.
And if there's like no, you know, if you're not separating, you know, the funds from like a sort of hot wallet or cold wallet arrangement, so basically some of it can't be accessed all at once, you know, and you can only access part of it at once, even as the bridge, you haven't like got good infrastructure security, you haven't audited your smart contracts, you haven't audited your front end. Like, there's so many different little things that can go wrong. And I think bridges deserve the bad rep they get, because most of them are just, they haven't done the most basic, simple things. And, you know, you can learn a lot from the centralized exchanges about how they do their security, because, you know, a lot of the time they don't get hacked. It hasn't happened in a long time, except FTX, who just got another $600 million. We don't know how that happened.
Oh yeah. That's a debatable. It's a hack.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
It's like, don't even know if is anyone even home at FTX, or is it, what's happening? Is it like running by itself? Are the people still there? What's?
Yeah, there's still people there. They've got like
new CEO and stuff.
Yeah, they appointed a new CEO basically for all the Chapter 11 bankruptcy stuff, but they still got a general counsel. They have a small technical team remaining. And they have a bunch of other people there that are just kind of sitting around waiting to see if they're going to get paid. But, you know, a lot of people are just there. They're not actually working, is what I'm hearing anyway. So, yeah, weird stuff. Weird stuff.
Yeah, very weird stuff. It's like everyone's waiting for the Netflix documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
Every hour there is a new news about it, you know, about the whole FTX saga. Have you been following the Autism Capital?
Yeah.
Twitter account?
It's so good.
It is so good, man. It is like everyone in the industry is following that Twitter account.
Yeah.
I've just that Twitter account see the numbers explode. It's like a few days ago I did a tweet like I think this is just like Sam Bankman-Fried has just done this to help Elon out with engagement on Twitter. Because there's just so much happening in the whole Twitter and blog, like
anyone. I did think that when Elon said Twitter usage and users at an all-time high, I'm like I wonder why.
Yeah. It's like there's not much other things going. I mean, there was the US Senate and House sort of the midterms and stuff. But apart from that, it'll be interesting to see. There's not much else happening on Twitter. This is the biggest sort of drama. What are your, I don't know, have you seen the news about Genesis and Gemini?
Yeah, I saw that last night. I don't really know anything about it. Luckily, I'm not exposed to either of those things. But also hearing rumors about Silvergate Bank and some other group I've never heard of before, like...
I don't know how much is true and not. And there's the Grayscale Capital, it's pretty big. And Digital Currency Group or something, DCG or something like that, which was the parent of this Genesis and Grayscale and all that. That's pretty big. It's like they've invested in lots and lots of startups. But then they had exposure to Three Arrows Capital as well. It's so much, there's so many connected things.
Yeah, like jump trading as well, like a bunch of these like kind of, you know, TradFi fund things that came into crypto with a lot of money and just like, you know, bailed people out and did this and did that and the other. And I think it's all coming home to roost now. But I don't know why like people think that, you know, these guys are TradFi, therefore, you know, they're going to have good risk management and they know what they're doing. And then they give all their money to like people like Alameda and do less due diligence than other people.
It's like when you go and buy a small business with 10 employees here, probably there's more due diligence done on some of the things that I'm reading. It's like, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts.
It's like people think, Sequoia and like, you know, like big VC firm, they'll be doing so much due diligence and stuff. They do. Okay. They do due diligence. If you are from the outside world, you know, you're not Stanford, ex-Stanford and ex all these things, you know.
Yeah.
If you are from the inner circle, they don't do due diligence. That's what I'm hearing and seeing in my eyes at the moment.
Even though they don't actually know much about the space or like what's working, like buying out bankrupt crypto businesses sounds like some of the worst bankruptcy bailout deals you can possibly do. Like, these companies have no revenue a lot of the time. It's just like straight up paper money. And anyway, I do have to say though, I do want to give a shout out to someone.
Yes.
Because, you know, due diligence seems like it just doesn't exist in this space. But I think that the fact that M11 Capital, which is part of Maven 11, we had some funds in the Maple Finance permission pool that they're running, and they've been lending out to various market makers for ages now, and they do some like really great reports and stuff like that. They stopped issuing loans to Alameda like in early September. So clearly someone on that team like actually dug and they found something they didn't like the smell of, and they stopped issuing to like essentially the biggest name in market making. In the space. Kudos to whoever that person was. I think it was a German, they told me. But yeah, you know, there is good due diligence that happens in this space. And I think that, you know, the kind of trust, the level of trust that creates and the reputation benefit that you can gain from that, I don't think is yet truly appreciated. But hopefully in time, we hear more and more stories like that about, you know, the people that saw it coming and dodged the bullet and can kind of prove it. That would be my hope anyway.
Yeah, I would love to hear stories like that. And I'd love to connect with those people. How did they first find out when everyone in the world thought like SBF is like the biggest mafia, you know, when it came to the whole crypto scene, that that's the biggest group running everything and everyone wanted funding from them, which is very bad idea now, yeah. Which is not now, but at that time, everyone, it's like at conferences and stuff, and everyone was, every founder was wanting to take a picture with him, get some credibility that, you know, this, that your startup is rubbing shoulders with Alameda and or SBF or FTX would make subsequent rounds easier, and you'd get so many other VCs interested in your startup if you had investment from them. It seemed like that. That's what was happening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had this magic wand where, you know, you could basically touch anything and, or they could basically touch anything and, you know, it would magically moon. Like, they created like 5 or 6 shit coins out of thin air themselves. Like,
yeah,
you know, Serum, for example, they never really built a product that anyone ever wanted to use ever at any point with Serum. It was just a token on Solana that FTX made. And that was enough for it to be worth just extraordinary sums of money. And there are other examples too, but yeah, they just had this magic wand where anything they touched turned to gold. They did a lot of lobbying as well. Like, I went to the Solana breakpoint in 2021, and when Solana hit $250 and like FTX was everywhere, they were like talking to basically all of these like, you know, Web2/TradFi guys who they'd flown in or, you know, had invited or whatever. They knew nothing about Web3 or the space, but wanted to invest. And they sort of created this environment and this vehicle to like showcase this magical ecosystem. Like, and they just like pulled these 21-year-old kids together, told them to build XYZ, gave them like, you know, $50 million at a $7 billion fully diluted valuation with like zero float. And they just rinsed and repeated this formula over and over and over again until, you know, the music stopped and it dipped from 250. But in that time, it was just insane, the things they were doing.
It was.
And I rang up my mate who was sitting on a very large bag of Solana at the time. And I was like, dude, this, like, I'm at this conference, the shit that I'm seeing, you gotta sell, man. This is the top. Cannot go higher than this. And that's the only top signal I've called correctly in my life. The only one.
You could have shorted it.
Like, yeah, I could have. I should have. I don't know why I didn't.
It's like, you know what it sounds like? This is, as I was saying, I've been going to US and probably since 2007, and I've seen the boom of the 2006-07 and then the crash of the 8 and 9 kind of thing in the property market. And there's all these properties everywhere, even in random places like Phoenix and stuff.
And
so many empty homes. And then they're just selling more and more every month. They're adding like $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 on the same house every month and reselling it to the next person. And over leveraged people owning 4 or 5 houses with hardly any income.
You want a mortgage. You want a mortgage. Exactly. You want a mortgage.
And new, it's going to come to an end. It's like, who's going to be buying at the end? It's like same thing, kind of. It felt like same thing. And that's happened. There is still, like, on the other side, last week, I was at, like, 7-8 days ago, I was at ETH San Francisco. 1,700 developers, mostly EVM-based developers, building under one roof. It's so big, the hackathon. Most hackathons in this part, like where I go in New Zealand, Australia, it's, you know, 150 people, like startup weekend type stuff, like 150, 200 people. And here it's like 1,700, just the devs alone. And then there would be other support staff and mentors and judges and other chains. Nearly every chain was there, like EVM chain was there. And over $300,000 in bounties, like lots, $5,000-$10,000 bounties from each chain, sort of. So a lot of winners and stuff, and so many projects, hundreds of projects, and a lot of these projects, not all, but some, will go down to become big, and we'll be using these products in future and stuff. So it's good to see. There's so many builders, thousands of builders, still building every day, and it's so much faster, man. It's just like our platform that I was earlier talking about. Like, you can create things. 2 minutes, 3 minutes. It's crazy how fast it is to create fully fleshed thing.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you see all these people who got 50 million, 20 million to build stuff, and they build shit coins and didn't build anything. It's like, it's such a waste of potential. And, you know, it's like, it feels like those were just like landing pages, those shit coins and stuff that FTX built. Nothing more than a fancy landing page.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to start a crypto project. Well, it has been anyway.
Yes.
But yeah, to actually then, Ethereum has this amazing ecosystem that you can really tap into, but so many different, smart contracts and products and tools. You know, a lot of that just didn't exist on Solana. A lot of it still doesn't exist and probably won't exist in the same way. It's just it's quite challenging to go from zero to one, and everything's in Rust, and if you've just been basically pulled off the street, handed a wad of cash and said, build a thing. How are you going to actually do that? You've got I think a lot of what I see in, the sort of Web3 founder space is young guys who, they want to launch a token. They want to see, success in that way. They want to be a part of an ecosystem or something like that. And that's all well and good, but I think a lot of the critical reasoning goes out the window, and it just becomes a rush to get something out the door to get the token launched at least, so you can get liquidity and sort of do all that kind of stuff as quickly as possible. But, when it comes to actually building the team, a lot of the time it's I need to find a blockchain developer or something, or a Rust developer, I don't know, whatever, or I'll build it myself, but not really realizing that, there's sort of multiple levels, and to make something quality in production, it actually requires a lot of time, a lot of energy, and ideally a team. You can't just do it by yourself.
Yeah.
That is the way these hacks happen. They just go, Jimmy, can you build a bridge? Yeah. No worries, mate.
Boom. Yeah.
Puts it together in a couple of weeks, and then, okay, we got a bridge now. Sweet. And I know that because we actually did that one time. We've built our own bridges before. We know what's involved, but that's easy to actually make it secure and have layered defenses and all that kind of stuff, or, to have, additional tooling for users, polished front end experiences, all that kind of stuff. You need multiple people working on this for months, years, and finding those people is very difficult. And a lot of them end up paying just excruciating sums of money to hire remote contractors who usually aren't very good, but they're getting paid $300K a year or something like that.
Yeah, that is true.
Develop low grade software. I mean, it's, I don't know how much longer that's going to continue given these market conditions, but that's where a lot of these projects end up. They pay someone, they do a thing for 6 months, then they leave to take some other gig with more money. And then, any domain knowledge about what that person worked on also walks out the door whistling.
it's like I've seen that meme. I love that. Heisenberg from Breaking Bad.
It's like
you're in danger. No, I am the danger, he says. And then it's the same thing. It's like the senior developer is leaving, and then someone else is taking over, and then the new guy taking over is like, oh, where is the documentation? And then the guy says, I am the documentation. And he's just leaving.
So exactly.
It's pretty much like that. Yeah. It's like, it is crazy. But I do think that, I don't know, there's 18,000. I was looking at the stats. There's about 18,000 Web3 developers. There's about 30 million Web2 developers. There's just not enough. So even if there's not enough money, there's very few quality Web3 developers in the world.
Controversial opinion.
Yeah,
I don't think the best Web3 developers in the world are actually Web3 developers. I don't think there's anything particularly special about Web3. And our best engineers here at Chainflip don't come from a Web3 background. In fact, I think there's only a couple that actually do, because a lot of the time when we get on the phone with these guys, we actually do the technical due diligence. They just don't have a solid grasp of, fairly basic computer science ideas. And, I honestly think the best people to work on blockchain are the people that have not really worked on it before, or maybe have had played around with it before, but, and sort of grasped the concept, but have spent a lot more time in some other specific, strictly typed fields, doing embedded software engineering, for example, I think is like very, very, a very good place to look for new smart contract engineers, for example, for various reasons. And yeah, I think, you know, cryptography people, mathematics people, computer science people, like these are all fantastic people to get on board to work on that sort of core infrastructure. But then of course, like, you know, a lot of the stuff with like the web front ends that we actually end up using.
Is
that blockchain? I mean, no, really. It's just JavaScript. Yeah. It's databases. It's passing data. It's the same thing. There's nothing particularly special about it. So
yeah,
if there's anyone listening that's currently recruiting or thinking about getting involved or anything like that, there's nothing special about Web3 developers. They're just developers with a fancy title.
Eventually, it will be just developers. You know, you don't say like, yeah, it's just developers. That's what it will become. It's like it will, as the usage picks up of Web3 tech, or as more businesses use things like smart contract and stuff, but which is, I think we are still quite far away from that feature. That brings me to, like, you know, with this whole saga that's happened and stuff, how long do you think all this is going to last?
In what sense? Like market wise, like
everything. Like, so first thing, market wise. Second thing is the sentiment, trust wise. Like, how long will it take for regular people to trust?
Well, I don't, I feel like I'm might be somewhat delusional perhaps, but I'm also hearing in my circles the similar sort of thing that, you know, despite everything, we never went below June lows. In fact, we're sitting quite comfortably above them. And the macro environment seems to be turning around as well.
Yes.
Probably pretty dramatically, it looks like. So I think there's every reason to be bullish, honestly. There's not a lot more that can go wrong. Okay, if Binance collapses or USDC collapses, like then we're in trouble. But there's no real reason to expect why that would happen. Like they've been very transparent for ages now about
they have, you know, been like especially USDC with their audits, or like, you know, they show their reserves and like how much US treasuries they own and all that stuff. So all the time, like once a month or something, they show. So what about DT, or what's the, like the Tether?
Nah, I'm not a Tether truther. Like USDT is fine. If it was going to blow up, it would have blown up in, you know, 2018. It would have blown up in 2018. Maybe it could have blown up in 2018. But after that, whoever's running it, like, just gone, yeah, probably not a good idea to mess with this. And so they, you know, I think over time they've shored it up and they've made it, you know, quite robust, because if it was going to pop this year, it would have happened when Terra exploded, but it didn't.
Yeah, I was expecting it at that time, actually, with the whole...
It would have popped like just now with FTX, you know, everyone was going, oh, get rid of your Tether, blah, blah, blah. It didn't pop. In fact, it didn't even lose its top spot. Nothing really happened. The peg got restored and I was like, oh, okay, everything's fine. I think at this point, like, I don't know, there's just a lot of people out there that really think that it's, you know, an incredibly dangerous asset or something like that, or it's like pinning the industry together and if we lose it, we're screwed. It's like, well, yeah, but no, like, it's just not. It's creating these very strange like market activities within the stablecoin market that are losing people money without any real reason. I don't think there's any real truth behind it at all. So yeah, I don't know, weird stuff. But yeah, I think generally, you know, things are looking up. Like, there's not a lot else that can go wrong. There's actually quite a bullish sentiment in the people that I'm speaking to. But in terms
so good to hear, man. That's awesome. I am going to make a short clip of this and going to post it everywhere I can to just lift people's sentiment up, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can get a lot of attention right now from, you know, heralding the end on Twitter. You get a lot of clout for that right now. But it's just like, you know, during the bull market, you can say a lot of like overhyped bullshit and get a lot of likes. It's like right now it's the same thing, just in the opposite direction. You herald the end, you get a lot of clout on Twitter. So it's like, don't. Twitter is a very bad sentiment place. Like, you're not gonna hear so many people saying like, oh yeah, I think 60K Bitcoin, like, you know, it's probably time to sell, something like that. No one's gonna like that, because people want to see it keep going up, right? So
yeah,
you're, the only thing you end up seeing is like, oh, we're going 100K in like 2 months or whatever. So people's actual sentiment is very rarely what you see on Twitter. It's an incredible amplifier of the general sentiment of the market.
You know,
but
what?
It's not, it's
you
not
should
good.
Make a should make the negative index of Twitter. No, I mean opposite index of Twitter. Like, you know, Jim Cramer or what's his name? The stocks guy in US. There's an opposite index of it. So pretty much there are bots that do exactly what the opposite of what he says. So if he says buy this stock, they go and they track that, and then that outperforms S&P 500. The opposite of NN outperforms him by many, many times. It's crazy.
That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Because the thing is that what happens is that all those people, even like listening to All In Podcast, is like nothing wrong with All In Podcast, but it's like all these guys, they were all, you know, hyped in the 2021 and like all that money, and they were all hyping all those things. I mean, in fact, Chamath is a massive investor in Solana. And now all those guys are now going all like, it's like the hell is breaking loose, and they want every tech company to fire everyone, and they're all like massively negative of everything right now. So it's like all VCs do that. All VCs, you know, it's like when everyone's investing, no one's doing due diligence, everyone's got FOMO and just is going all in. And then when everyone's running to the hills, even though everyone knows the saying that be greedy when everyone is fearful and be fearful when everyone is greedy. Everyone knows that, but no one can practice it in real life.
It's like, you know, buy the dip. It's the classic crypto expression, but it seems that very few of the, you know, fund managers and that sort of thing that you see publicly are living that principle. But I've spoken with a bunch of our investors over the last week, and you know, they all think that one of them thinks the world is ending. The rest of them think that, you know, next year is actually probably going to be a pretty good year for crypto. And I agree with that. I think it'll probably take, you know, another, at least till Christmas. Like, I think everyone wants a break. I don't think there's going to be too much happening between now and then on the positive side explicitly. But I do think like going into next year, we could definitely see some really positive results, especially if the macro environment continues improving, which by all accounts it will. Inflation is going down. China is unlocking. Russia is losing the war faster than people can even keep up with. Gas prices are down. Gas storage is full in Europe. And more of these like problems just seem to be resolving themselves all around the same sort of time. So I think the macro environment is going to, you know, be pretty nice next year, actually, funnily enough. And I think as a result, we'll see crypto might lag a little just because, you know, some people might have gotten scared away. But I don't think that's how retail works. Like, I use my mum as a yardstick. Because we're like, oh, Simon, I heard there was a Bitcoin crash. Should I buy? That's the sort of shit that she says, you know? Like, I think like people overestimate. Like, I think people realize that, you know, in the general retail world that like, you know, okay, Bitcoin's come down a lot or Ethereum's come down a lot, whatever, you know, maybe now's a good time to get in. Like that is how they think. They don't think like the people that are actually looking at it every day.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. The counterpoint to that is that because of the whole FTX saga, all the institutional money is going to stay away from crypto for the next foreseeable future until there is clear and concise regulation that they know that they'll be safe.
I don't know who people are talking about when they say institutional investors. What institutional investors? What institutional money? Like, they didn't buy crypto. They bought fucking Alameda Research. And look what happened with that. You know, like the institutional money, I don't think is like really flowing directly into crypto. It's been kind of flowing into these companies that are sort of adjacent to it. But that doesn't really help the market at all. You know, buying Coinbase shares is great and all, but it doesn't actually support the price of Bitcoin. And I think that that's where a lot of the institutional money ends up. Or what happens is they open up a fund within their own fund, you know, for example, Jump Crypto is a good example. And they're not going away because like, in spite of everything, those funds have been making money and, you know, they're on a multi-year time frame anyway. Like most funds that get invested into have like, you know, a 5 to 10 year redemption period. So the money's here and it'll stay. And there is plenty of funding still out there. The people have been closing rounds all year So I don't know what people mean when they say, oh, institutional, blah, 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 get an ETF and then all the retirement funds are going to buy Bitcoin. It's like, that's not going to happen. That was never going to happen. Like,
yes.
And the DeFi and summer wave, like everything like that, the whole market run we just had, there's this idea out there that, oh, it's the institutional money coming in. And the institutional money definitely did come in, but it wasn't the first time. It won't be the last time. And it wasn't even the main thing, you know. It was a lot of wholesale traders, really, and a lot of retail as well. You know, it kind of came in waves, but, you know, institutional money scared away by this. Come on. I mean, Lehman Brothers, like this is the it went wrong because it started emulating the TradFi world. It's not because like it is particularly, you know, damaging by itself, you know, and I think the regulation coming in, there's now going to be a much stronger push to regulate those centralized businesses. I think, I think a lot of people now realize that the real threat in the ecosystem isn't unregistered securities of some ICO or whatever, you know, it's people like SBF and CZ and these people who other people are trusting with billions and billions and billions of dollars. Dokwan
and all these people. Yeah.
And, you know, basically, are they running a Ponzi scheme? Like, they shouldn't be allowed to run a Ponzi scheme on-chain or off-chain. And so I think that's the kind of regulation that we're going to see pop up real quick, targeting centralized businesses in particular who are, you know, performing these kind of activities without, you know, being able to back up the reserves of whatever they're doing. So we'll see a lot of that. And hopefully the decentralized protocols get specifically excluded from this kind of stuff. And why wouldn't it be, you know? They're all very transparent throughout this whole year. It's a year from hell, you know.
Yes.
The DeFi protocols, the ecosystem in Solana was all backed up by wrapped tokens provided by Alameda. So that failed. But anything that was like, you know, on Ethereum or whatever else, like DeFi has held up remarkably. Like,
it has. It has.
Been flawless. It served its purpose to the nth degree. Like,
yes.
You can't fault it.
It's like after this year, I've become a bit more of a Ethereum bull. And I do think that the flippening will happen in the next few years, in the next 2-3 years, as Ethereum's brand recognition gets more and more, because Ethereum is 5 years behind, you know, or maybe 6 years behind compared to when Bitcoin was launched to when Ethereum was launched. So it has got that much ground to make up, but the way it has been growing and it has been improving, and the amount of developers in that ecosystem compared to the amount of people developing on Bitcoin, there's no comparison. It's like what, like
no comparison.
920 to 1? If no, probably that is even too generous to Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, like, to 1. What can you develop on Bitcoin? Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing.
We had the light. It looked like Lightning Network was going to be a thing for a hot minute there, and it is, and it works. But it's just like, you know, Bitcoin is not going to be a payment system for the world.
No, it's not.
There's no point.
Yeah.
When you look, if you've asked me that question a few years ago, I would have had a probably different answer, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, I don't know.
The Lightning Network is coming and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. But now, like, with the EVM ecosystem, like, the fact that you can do all of this swapping and lending and insurance and, like, all this other stuff on chain, in one ecosystem, in USD or Ethereum or whatever you want. Like, it's just a no-brainer. Like,
and it's not even considering all the new innovation that's yet to come that I saw people building and things on like ZK rollups and stuff. The transactions are getting so much faster, so much greener, so much more energy efficient. Ethereum has just had the first step of the merge. There's still the verge and the splurge and the surge and the, you know, all those things, like the 5-step that Ethereum has. Like, I don't know. Don't ask me all the names, but I'd explain them. But pretty much by the end of it gets to 100,000 transactions per second. And that's just layer one, Ethereum, and the protocols that work on top of that on layer two. And there's so many of them. It's getting so much faster than Visa or any of these things can ever be, and so much greener than that, and more energy efficient, that I am feeling a lot more positive on that side. That long term, the future is bright for blockchain and crypto and all these things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next few years. I think there's a period of consolidation that needs to happen still. I think it'll probably be, you know, pretty good for Bitcoin and Ethereum next year, and, you know, a lot of the larger protocols as well. But, Yeah, I think there's still a lot of projects out there that maybe just aren't working out, aren't really useful, don't have much demand. And I think it's going to take a while to, you know, I guess, figure out what's good, what's necessary, what's sticking around, what can be improved upon. You know, I think there's been like lots of examples. I don't know how many NFT marketplaces got created last year, but it's got to be upwards of 100, and we don't need 100. You know,
No. It was 100 every week, man. 100 every week. We probably will have a marketplace. Smart contract people can create it in 2 minutes. It's 100 every week or every day. It's great. It is great. Absolutely insane. The number of marketplaces that had reached out to me to help them and stuff, it was crazy.
Yeah. Like you can't just rock up and be the new OpenSea. It doesn't work like that. No. You can't just
started in 2018. They did their time in the crypto winter for 2-3 years of, you know.
Same with Uniswap, you know, they were around in 2018, and it took 2 years for anyone to give shit about what they were doing at all.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, boom. And you know, there was a vampire attack with SushiSwap, and that was very interesting. We all learned a lot, but no one is trying to replace Uniswap anymore. Thank God. Everyone's realized that, oh no, like, you know, brand recognition, like, it's better if there's just one. If we centralize the liquidity in one decentralized protocol, it's better for everyone. So yeah, hopefully people realize that too with things like NFT marketplaces and lending protocols and stuff like that. Yes. One is enough. One is better than many. And there are cases where, you know, there are products that can be vastly improved upon, and, you know, early ideas can be taken and then improved upon greatly, you know, with, you know, cross-chain protocols or insurance products we haven't seen much since Nexus Mutual, you know, but I imagine there are better ways to do that that haven't really yet been explored. There's a whole range of different things, but we just haven't figured out where those improvements can be made and what new stuff comes up. You know, if you'd ask me, you know, like, there's just no way of predicting what you can have on chain. Like, I would never have predicted that DYDX would be possible as a product. It's like a high frequency derivatives exchange that operates mainly on chain. It's like, is that possible? I wouldn't think so, but I think it's a really great product, for example. I think it's still got a little ways to go in terms of liquidity, but that seems to be changing quite quickly as well. And if we focus on replacing the centralized services that we all use in crypto, I think that's a great place to start with, like, products that are in demand, people will use, and where innovation can really help the user base of Web3 get away from the stuff that we know is risky.
And the interesting thing is that a lot of these projects that are failing are centralized projects. They're not the DeFi projects. People don't realize that. People don't even know what's DeFi and DeFi difference. A lot of people they just think, oh, Bitcoin bad, a scam.
FTX is DeFi.
Yeah.
Oh my God!
Alameda is DeFi. I'm just kidding. I've got just a couple more questions. One of that is that I really like that you are talking with positive people, and because a lot of the listeners are early stage founders, what are some of the? Have you been talking to any investors or any early stage funds that you can recommend that would they are still feeling positive? They are still investing and stuff?
Well, we're at the stage where we're exploring doing an equity round at the moment as a sort of series B, if you will. So a lot of the funds that I have spoken to a lot of our investors over the last week or so.
Yes.
In the wake of all of the FTX stuff. But I don't really know who is doing early stage investment at the moment. I haven't been asking though.
Yes.
I do know though that there's like, you know, a dozen American funds who have raised $100 million plus rounds in the last 6 months, some of which have been able to fully close out, some of which have been able to close out enough, a couple of which have failed. So there's definitely less money coming into the fundraising space at the moment, but there is still money out there. I don't really know who's deploying, but I would say that if there are any founders out there that are trying to raise, particularly with the Web3 stuff.
Yes.
That's the only thing I can really speak to. I have no idea what's happening in the Web2.
No, Web3, mainly Web3. That's
Web3, just wait. Just don't try raise before Christmas. Like even if FTX hadn't exploded 6 weeks out from Christmas, you know, most funds want to like wrap up any deals that are currently ongoing, close any like new tickets or anything like that. They want to clean the slate before the holiday season. So I, you know, if I were trying to close this pre-seed or a seed or anything like that right now, I would be cautious about reaching out to investors because, you know, you don't ask to get married with someone the week their mother died. Like that's just a very bad idea. And that's kind of what's happening at the moment.
Yes. That is such a good analogy. Like, look, yeah, definitely. I will share this advice with people I meet on a day to day, because I do meet with lots of early stage founders and stuff because I run workshops and all sorts of things and speak at events and stuff. But I happen to meet and people ask me these questions. So that's why I like to get and hear other people's views as well. Final question is, do you have an ask? Is there anything you're looking for? Are you looking team to hire, people to buy or product, anything? Feel free to share.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. If you want to find out more about Chainflip, you can go to chainflip.io. We're launching our testnet today, actually. I don't know when this podcast is going out, but you'll be able to like play around with the network. And it'd be really great if you want to have some fun with some decentralized cross-chain technology. We got a fun program coming out in a couple of weeks, which will be awesome. And yeah, just check out the light paper, brand new. And if you like what we're doing, stick around and wait for the token launch and wait for the product launch. And then, you know, swap your crypto. if you like it, stick around. If you don't. I can't ask more than that.
Yeah.
We also have a jobs board. We've just closed up our latest round of roles, but yeah, keep an eye on it. Stick around in the community and opportunities might show up as well.
Yeah. Do you guys just hire in Berlin or in Germany, or do you guys hire all around the world remote as well?
Yeah. So we're one of those weird companies that actually has an office and are very serious about it.
Yeah.
Like we're not, okay, we have flexibility and stuff and work from home Wednesdays and all the usual 2022 stuff. But, you know, Web3 is predominantly remote and I don't get it. I don't, especially in this fast moving space, I don't see how you can build secure, useful products like in a remote capacity for any meaningful length of time. Okay. You can do it for 6 months, but like, you're going to manage a team of 50 from your couch? Like, good luck. I don't get it. But, you know, there are lots of teams that have been very successful in doing it as well. But yeah, we're in Berlin for the most part. We do have remote staff. Some of them in Europe, one in New Zealand, actually. Exacala Def. G'day, Roy, if you're listening.
Yes.
and a couple of engineers in Australia as well from the Melbourne office. So yeah, we are we have some remote people, but a lot of us are new. And it makes a lot of things a lot easier.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yeah. I mean, that's our goal as well, to have a central location. And then once every couple of months, at least have the core team meet and stuff and all that. And have some sort of connection, at least with the core team. And smaller roles, not so involved roles, have distributed and stuff. So, So that's very cool. I will put all the links to your project, your website, everything underneath in the description, in the show notes, wherever this goes. And wish you best of luck for Chainflip and everything that you guys are building.
Likewise, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in and watching this or listening to this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. You know the drill. Leave a comment, please subscribe or share it with a friend. Now, if you are building something really interesting in this space, then reach out to me. My DMs are open. I'm at Sam Kamani on Twitter or on LinkedIn or on TikTok or on any platform. Just go and search for my name. Reach out to me. I would love to help you. I would love to have a conversation with you if time permits. So, having said that, I want to wish you best of luck to whatever you are building. I know that about 35 to 40% of my listeners are founders themselves. So I want to say best of luck and go build that next innovation.